Right. Okay, so, chapter... Chapter 12 here. All right. So chapter 12, evolutionary psychopathology, Darwinian medicine. Depending who you talk to, new fields kind of divide a little bit, so we'll use the terms that suggest what we call evolutionary psychopathology is the study of mental illnesses within an evolutionary context, and Darwinian medicine is evolutionary theory as applied to both psychiatric and non-psychiatric health issues. So they're really kind of overlapping fields in the terminology here, but we'll sort of divide them this way. Now, when we look at medically related issues or medical theory, the traditional approach to medicine was very much driven by approximate approach. So cause and effect. So your etiology is the cause and the pathogens are the mechanism. Traditionally, I mean, as we've discussed, proximate level interpretations deal with how questions. How did the stimulus cause this outcome? Evolutionary medicine approaches tend to focus more at an ultimate level of causation. They tend to ask more of the why questions. We've discussed a little bit about parasites and hosts earlier in the course. Back when we talked about sexual selection, we talked about the Red Queen theory and how there's an ongoing arms race between hosts and their parasites. Parasites develop an adaptation to get into the host. The hosts, after probably a whole bunch of them die or are negatively affected, eventually evolve some sort of counter-adaptation, requiring parasites to evolve some new adaptation, and on and on and on it goes. The result of this is that when parasites get into a host, there are symptoms. Now, in a traditional medical approach to this, symptoms are seen as pathological events, really all symptoms, which means they need to be treated. So if you've got some symptomology of a disease or an infection, treat it. That's the traditional. Well, by traditional, I shouldn't say traditional is difficult. I don't mean like traditional hunter-gatherer medicine. I mean sort of the traditional 17th through 21st century mainstream medical approach to things, Western medicine. So we've got adaptations in the parasites. Parasites have evolved adaptations to allow them to propagate copies of themselves. That's what they're trying to do. Get as many copies of themselves out into the next generation before, the host's immune system nails them. Hosts have developed adaptations, have evolved adaptations to try to destroy or repel or expel the parasites that get into the host. These are defensive mechanisms that have evolved for the protection of the individual. Now, these symptoms are actually beneficial to the host in the long run because they evolve to try to get rid of parasites, either kill them or expel them. So, if you treat symptoms that are involved with adaptations of the parasite, fine, that's good. But if you're treating symptoms of a disease, a disorder, that are actually caused by the host, then you're interfering with the adapted processes of the host to get rid of the parasite. I'll give you an example here. Bacterial infection. So bacteria, as you almost certainly know, single-cell microbes here. If your body gets infected with bacteria, your leukocyte endogenous mediators are released around the body. And one of the things they do is punch up your body temperature. Okay, so once the limbs are rolling around, your body temperature goes up. The other thing that the other main effect that's caused here is iron gets pulled out of the bloodstream and gets stored in the liver. So as blood goes through the liver, iron gets taken out of blood and gets sequestered. What does this do? So you get a bacterial infection. What happens? You get fever and fatigue. temperature's up, so you're feeling feverish. Iron's being pulled out of your bloodstream. It makes you feel tired. Okay, your blood's not as effective at carrying oxygen now. You're feeling tired. But these are both adaptations on the part of the host. Bacteria need the iron to be able to reproduce. If they don't have access to iron, they can't reproduce as fast. And most bacteria that are going to get into a person are susceptible to higher temperatures. So the higher you can raise the bodily temperature, the harder you're making it for those bacteria to reproduce. It's not an optimal environment for reproduction. It may, in fact, actually cook some of them and kill them right off. But more likely, it's just slowing down the reproductive cycle. Removing the iron, making iron harder to get for the bacteria, means it's going to take them longer to get enough iron to be able to replicate. Again, all what that does is gives the body time for its own immune system, white blood cells, to get in there and gobble up the bacteria. But you go to the doctor because you got a bacterial infection, what do? It's like, yeah, I got this fever. It's like, well, we'll bring your temperature down, and I'm feeling, you know, really lethargic. It's like, okay, we'll give you some iron supplements, some bioavailable iron supplements. What are you doing? You're just countering your body's evolved natural defenses to deal with the bacteria. You know, as opposed to, yep, you got a bacterial infection. Yeah, I'm hot and tired. It's like, yep, go home. Drink plenty of fluids. Rest. But can't you give me something? I could. But let me explain what your body's doing. Right? I need to be functional. Yeah. Okay, you'll be sick longer. Sure, I can take the symptoms away, says the doctor. You know what the doctor should say. He's like, yeah, we can fix that, but you're going to be sick longer. Your call. Let's take a look at a few others. Let's take a look at cholera. Okay? Cholera has probably, you know, killed more people than just about anything else out there. In the case of cholera, the symptoms that cholera produces really benefit the spread of cholera. So you get cholera by drinking contaminated water. If you got water with little sort of white fleckies in it, you probably shouldn't drink that. At least most people shouldn't. It produces diarrhea. And given enough time, that dehydration from diarrhea will kill the host. So it can take people out actually relatively quickly, especially the young and those that are already infirm. So you go, wait a minute, parasites, they shouldn't want to kill the host, right? You kill the host, what's the parasite living off of? Well, usually, yeah, but in the case of cholera, it's got a really rapid reproductive cycle. So even if the activities of cholera kill off the host, the net benefit, the net result is a lot more cholera has gotten back into the water system, which means it's going to get into a lot more hosts. So this is actually very adaptive for cholera, which is a very rapidly replicating microbe. So those symptoms associated with cholera, yeah, treat those. You just got a bacterial infection that's making you a bit feverish. Probably don't do anything about that. If you got cholera, yeah, that needs some treatment. Bubonic plague, another biggie here, sometimes called the Black Death. You can get bubonic plague in lots of different ways. The most common way is to be infected from a bite of a flea. Now, the flea actually was infected by biting a rodent that was infected by being bitten by an infected flea. You see how this goes. What happens, why is the flea biting? Well, fleas will bite people, but here's what happens, and it's a fascinating little cycle. Bacteria multiply in the flea. They multiply very rapidly in the stomach of the flea. So the flea bites something that's infected. The bacteria gets into the flea, gets into the blood meal, into the flea's stomach, and this is a great place for the bacteria to reproduce. So they reproduce very, very rapidly. So rapidly, in fact, that they fill up the flea's entire stomach with bacteria. And then push up the flea's throat. So the flea's now starving because it can't actually consume a blood meal, right? Because its stomach is filled with bacteria. There's no room for its food. What this starving flea then does is just voraciously bite at its host. It keeps biting and biting and biting and biting, trying to feed, trying to suck blood in. Every time it bites, a little bit more of the bacteria get expelled into the bloodstream of the host. This now moves the bacteria into a new host, a mammalian host. Now, in mammals, the bacteria doesn't reproduce in the stomach. It reproduces inside of cells. And your body's solution to this, the immune system, is to try to clean the cells out and collect the bacteria then in the lymph nodes. So you've got your if you don't know, you've got your circulatory system, then you got your lymph system. And this is a part of your body that's involved in cleaning impurities out of the blood. Now there's nodes in the throat, the armpits, the groin, called the lymph nodes, and these are kind of collection locations for, you know, all the yucky stuff that's being strained out of your blood. So if, you know, you get a cold or something, it's like, you know, oh, my throat is swollen. Yeah, that's your lymph nodes. They're filling up with, you know, to use the technical term, goo. It's probably not the technical term, right? In terms of bubonic plague was also called the Black Death. I mean, it's catchy. From a marketing, branding point of view, why is it called the Black Death? Because so much bacteria would collect in the nodes that they'd start to go a bit necrotic, and you'd get the blackening of the skin around the armpit, the groin, and the throat. It's the Black Death. Okay. What eventually happens here is eventually so much bacteria has been collected in the infected person or rat or whatnot, they spill out into the bloodstream, at which point things get really, really bad. And usually death follows pretty quickly. There's various forms of bubonic plague. There's three bacteria that are forms of bubonic plague. The septicemic form leads to infections of organs. And this one causes bleeding in these organs and under the skin. This one actually is not as contagious, because to be infected, you have to get in contact with blood. So the skin has to be punctured, you have to get access to bodily fluids, it's got to get into your own bloodstream that way. So this is not as infectious, but it's generally pretty fatal. Septicemic forms without, you know, quick treatment with effective antibiotics, you're just probably going to die. Pneumonic forms, though, they infect the lungs. So the bacteria is doing much of its reproduction in the cells of the lungs. And coughing, now here's the thing. The coughing is a host adaptation to try to get the bacteria out of your lungs. So this is, coughing is an adaptation to expel the bacteria from the host's body. But this also works really well for the bacteria, because you cough, you atomize little droplets of fluid out of your lung, which are now packed with bacteria. If somebody else inhales those, zoom, straight into the lung. You can skip the whole flea as a vector of infection product. So pneumonic forms are very infectious, although not always, one of them is quite fatal, but the other one is not as likely to be fatal even without treatment. In terms of bubonic plague and history, between 1347 and 1351, at least a third to possibly as much of a half of the European population, like the entire European population, died from bubonic plague. Just entire towns ceased to exist. Some towns actually quarantined themselves. Stunning insight into this, but prevented anyone from coming in, and just everyone died. Bubonic plague continued to crop up over the next, this is about 600, 550 years in Europe, England, for example, up in Edinburgh in the 18th century, early 18th century, it was an infection of bubonic plague that broke out, and they just quarantined the whole sort of apartment block, by which means they basically boarded everyone up in it and just didn't open the apartment block back up until there was no noise coming from it anymore a couple of years later. So after everyone was definitely dead, that was treatment. You get such, charming pictures down here of death
wandering around and dancing with people, so bubonic plague would take anyone. So massive die-off. Caused, of course, by Europeans' own greed for marmot skin, or marmot pelts. So bubonic plague came out of Asia, China, Mongolia. The local people had a taboo against shooting sick marmots. You don't shoot a sick marmot because the sick marmot's got bubonic plague. But Europeans decided they really liked marmot pelts to trim their capes and their hats, and so there was a big economic demand for it. Well, what are Mongolian tribes people going to do? If crazy Europeans want to pay insane amounts of money for dead marmots, they started shooting any old marmot, including infected ones. Put them on the trade routes and gradually worked their way into Europe. And in fact, we can trace the spread of bubonic plague coming into the eastern into the Mediterranean, coming from the overland trade routes, and then working its way throughout the Mediterranean basin, then up overland through Europe, up into England and the Scandinavian countries, all following trade routes. Okay. So, there's some bacteria and hosts and parasites responses. Talk just a little bit about viruses. Viruses are, well, they're not really alive. They're submicroscopic strands of DNA and RNA. They have to have an assist, if you will, in being able to reproduce. They can't do it on their own. So they are a self-replicating system, but they need some other organism cells to be able to do it. Because of this, they're what we'd call obligate parasites. They cannot successfully reproduce, go into an active form without a host. And there's a whole bunch of them out there. Rabies, yellow fever, smallpox, West Nile, herpes, these are all viruses. and they're very difficult to treat, as it turns out. Here's a popular one, Ebola. Developed in popularity over the last maybe 15, 20 years. Ebola is actually a class of what are called filoviruses. Early symptoms look very much like the flu, so sometimes diagnosis is delayed. You get a headache, joint and muscle pain, abdominal pain, weakness, nausea. So very flu-like symptoms. But these then progress into more severe symptoms, including diarrhea, vomiting, and here comes the fun one. The internal and external hemorrhaging of the body, the coughing and spraying of blood from various orifices, which has become sort of the signature keynote of Ebola in both literature and movie format. Ebola is transmitted by bodily fluid contact. So as long as you don't get an infected individual's bodily fluids into you, you're not going to get Ebola. So as long as you can practice barrier-safe medicine, so gowned, gloved, masked, goggled, you're fine. You can treat people with Ebola with very little risk to yourself. The problem is if you don't have access to things like surgical gowns, rubber gloves, masks, then you've got a good chance of being infected, and the infection leads to 50 to 90% fatality. And so there are different forms of Ebola, but pretty bad. The traditional treatment for Ebola was to take someone who was infected with Ebola, move them to the Ebola hut, put them with all the other people that were infected with Ebola, throw in a whole bunch of food and water, seal up the hut, come back 3 or 4 weeks later. If there was anyone still alive by that point, you could go in and get them. They would probably be okay at that point. If you came back to the hut and called out and nobody was saying anything, then you just set it on fire and walked away. That's the traditional indigenous medicinal form of treatment of Ebola. The best you could do, right? Without modern medical techniques and attempts to control viruses, there's really not much else you can do. You're either going to survive it or you're just going to die. So again, the coughing and spraying and bleeding of blood from the eyes and everyone else, that's an adaptation for the Ebola virus to get out into somebody else. It's not an adaptation on the part of the... Well, I mean, it is expelling some of the virus from the body, but really, it's not a good way. It's not an adaptation on the part of the host there, because now you're bleeding out as well. So it's bad. So we've seen a few things here that are both parasite host benefits, like with the bubonic plague there, the pneumonic forms, that the coughing. So this expels the parasite from the host, but it also spreads this to other potential hosts. Now think about this in terms of selfish gene, right? The genes want to, metaphorically, survive. The best chance of them doing that is to make sure their vehicle makes it. So if you're filling up with bubonic plague, get it out of you as fast as possible. Oh yeah, you may infect others, but hey, if you make it, then he's got a chance for further reproduction. So in some cases, these can benefit both. Now our immune system, got lymphocytes there, so B cells that come from the bone marrow, T cells from the thymus, they respond to antigens, so any sort of foreign molecule that gets in, this is going to activate your immune system. Your B cells produce the antibodies, which are proteins. These go circulating off through the blood. They latch on to the antigens, and then basically this is a marker that brings white blood cells in to destroy the antigens, these foreign molecules. T cells also help out with this in antibody production. Now, the thing about this is that your immune system is stunningly complex. It has to be, because there are millions, at least, of different kinds of antigens that could get into you. You take a pharmacology course or biology course, they'll talk about this sort of lock, that is the antibody and key antigen analogy for things. Now just think about this. There's millions of doors, and I don't actually like the lock and key, with lock as the antibody and key as the antigen, because now my next analogy breaks down. There's millions of doors out there in the world with locks on it. How many keys can you carry around? You can't carry around one for everything. So my analogy completely collapses due to the poor foresight of pharmacologists in terms of what I would like to do with my lecture. But look at it this way. There's millions of antigens out there. You can't store enough antibodies in your body. There's just not space to have a whole bunch of them on hand, ready and waiting for when you get infected by some antigen. But you do have room in your body to store at least a few of each type, right? So this is why there's a lag, right? You get infected, you start to get sick, it takes a while for your immune system to deal with it. Because your immune system's got to take those few stored antibodies and use them to replicate, and make more. Okay, so the parasite has a bit of a, the antigens have got a bit of a lead time on this. Antigens come in pretty easily, then the antibodies have to be put into production. So once a specific antigen gets ID'd by a lymphocyte, then that lymphocyte starts replicating rapidly, starts producing the specific antibodies. Over generations, over time, through speciation, our immune systems have evolved, and they've stored the various genes that are involved in making various antibodies. So we've got collections of these, and different people have different genetic components to their immune system. The part of the genome that's involved in this is called the MHC, or the major histocompatibility complexes. These are a series of genes that code for disease detectors, so basically the antigens. So that's what these genes are doing. If you get into this stuff and you look in the literature, you might find these listed as human leukocyte antigens, or HLAs for humans. HLAs are just, a species-specific form of MHCs. The literature is slowly moving to just calling these all major histocompatibility complexes, because it's the more generic term, but you still get a few people that are very specifically just working with human subjects and patients that still continue to use the HLA designators there. Let's take a look at mice here, because this is where some of the initial work was, go back about 25 years, was being done. Male mice secrete the byproducts of their MHCs, genes in the urine. So the MHGs produce, remember, cells. Cells just produce, oh, pardon me, not cells, genes. What are genes producing? Well, genes are ultimately involved in protein production. Okay, so there's your antibodies. And eventually these things will break down in the body. Cells don't last forever. They break down. They get excreted. So the byproducts in mice, at least, of the immune system get excreted through the urine. And apparently this leads to a particular olfactory signature for the urine. Now, we humans can't really smell the difference in mouse urine, male mouse urine, but mice can. So in fact, when a female mouse meets up with a male mouse for the first time, sort of the first thing the male does is pee a little bit. It's not like it's like, oh, I'm so excited to meet a pretty female mouse, I just peed. You know, wouldn't Disney shows with Mickey and Minnie be interesting if they went that way? Oh, hi, Minnie. That's weird. Yeah. The female rushes over and smells the pee, smells the urine. Then we find that there's a preference. So the female has a greater preference to mate with males that show genomically MHCs that are most different from her own. Remember, heterozygosity, greater variation you can put into your offspring, right? It's probably an advantage here. Might also reduce things like incest. If she smells a lot like you, maybe you're closely related. Right? Now, again, what we've got here is the pea doesn't contain, you know, if you will, an itemized blueprint of the male mouse's genome with respect to the major histocompatibility complex genes, but it does contain phenotypic markers, the olfactory cues, right? Signals of the genome. So this is the scent of the urine is a phenotypic indicator of the underlying genotype of the immune system. So given that one presumes female mouse or female mice are somewhat familiar with the smell of their own urine, if they sniff the male's urine, they can identify some degree of similarity or difference in that. And they show a greater preference for those that are most different from themselves. Now, in humans, they don't usually sniff each other's pee. I once heard a comedian say something, you know, the great thing with the internet is no matter how weird your kink is, you can always find at least six other people in the world that will share it. So I'm sure there's a few people that sniff pee, and that would probably be what you would get out of an abnormal psychology course. But usually this is not how humans engage in issues of mate selection. In humans, we release byproducts of our MHCs in our sweat. So the olfactory, these olfactory markers are released through sweating. Now, one I've been interested in for a while, I've never actually found any specific evidence on this, but I'm curious if, as well, MHC byproducts may be released in saliva. So this is just speculation on my part, okay? But we definitely know it's involved in sweat there. Although, I take it back. Actually, you know what? I just remembered something. I gotta be careful. You can sample for MHCs with saliva, but that's right, because in fact, actually, Dr. Hurd here on campus in our department does that. But it's unclear whether or not people could detect differences, you know, phenotypic differences in individuals' MHC by sampling saliva, i.e., kissing. But we definitely can, you know, get saliva samples to use for genetic testing. That can give us access to genetic information by running it through machines, but I'm not sure whether or not we can actually, as individuals, utilize these. But you think about it, you know, maybe some individuals you have this, you know, massive physical attraction to, and yet, you know, you finally move on to the kissy stays, and it's just something missing. It's just not there. Other people who you think you should really not get along with, you know, we'd be terrible together, but, you know, there's that burning passion that you just can't explain. Well, maybe it's all in the spit or the smell, right? Could be in the olfactory cues. Klaus Wedekind, in fact, has shown this. A classic study by Wedekind going back in the 90s had 49 men. 49 men were requested to wear a simple white cotton T-shirt for 2 days. They were not to eat any spicy foods, use perfumes, scented soaps. Matter of fact, they were not supposed to bathe at all for the 2 days. Klaus Wedekind then collected the 49 shirts from the men, took samples for subsequent genetic analysis, and had the 44 women come in and sniff the shirts. The women were then requested to rate the shirts on the following criteria: sexiness, pleasantness, and intensity. The women, too, gave blood samples that they used to do a genetic analysis of their major histocompatibility complexes. What they found by subsequently comparing the MHCs of the women and the men and the ratings of the women was that the women, similarly to mice, showed a preference for the sense of men that had maximally different MHCs from themselves. Bum, bum, bum. So in terms of things like sexiness and pleasantness, the intensity didn't correlate at all with issues of MHC, but in terms of sexiness and pleasantness, they rated those shirts that smelled most different from, well, we presume had indicators that were most different from their own MHCs present. Now, some other interesting things about women's sense of smell. It varies. In fact, it's most sensitive during peak periods of conception. So their sense of smell alters, women's sense of smell alters through the ovulatory cycle. So they are most likely to be able to conceive. That is when their sense of smell is at its peak. Okay, if that's the time to sniff out a good male, a good genetically fit male, that's when you need that little advantage. Contraceptive pills mess with this. Contraceptive pills actually stop this. The sense of smell actually gets interfered with, doesn't vary throughout the monthly cycle, because what's a contraceptive pill do? Well, it basically tricks the woman's body into thinking that she is, in fact, pregnant. If you are pregnant and you cannot conceive, there's no point trying to sniff out a better male to mate with, because you can't. It's just a waste of energy. Don't put the energy into making an enhanced sense of smell if it's going to confer no particular advantage to you. But once you're no longer pregnant, there we go. Now, just an interesting little thing that I've speculated on, and there is some data actually, in fact, to show this, but you know, no one's done a specific study on this. Divorce rate has been steadily increasing over the last 50 years. Use of contraceptive pills in the West has been steadily increasing over the last 50 years. So, see how this is going? See how this is going? And these divorces often happen after 2 to 5 years. So, women are on contraceptive pills. They find some guy. They think he's pretty special. They settle down. After a few years, it's time to start the family. They go off the contraceptive pills so they can get pregnant. Ba-ba-bam! Their sense of smell peaks up. They sniff their guy and go, ooh. Ooh, what was I thinking? Oh dear. Bada-boom, bada-bang, divorce is in the air. There's some correlational evidence that actually fits with this. I don't know if that's the case. I don't have a specific cause and effect. But, hey, you know, you're messing with the evolved system of mate choice. You gotta take your chances. Incidentally, some work is currently being done on actually a better form of male contraceptive. There have been some in the past that have been used, but they have massive consequences with respect to huge hormonal loads that have been taken. But there's some new stuff coming out that may actually work much more effectively. And given that male sense of smell does not seem to change at any point for them, basically women always smell good because it's a guy thing, you know. There we go. Probably the better way to go. All right. So, again, as I said, HLAs, human leukocyte antigens, the human-specific form of MHCs, there are a variety of them out there. So in the same way that we can talk about the allelic forms of various genes, we give various letters and numerical designators to the HLA genes as well. And they generally are a letter or a couple of letters followed by anywhere up to maybe 9 to 13 numbers. So, but just, you know, to use the first couple of values here, or parameters, you know, so just to give you a sense, you know, we've got A series, you know, A1s, A2s, B series, and DR series of HLA genes. Anyways, Vedekind, in another study, had subjects rate
perfumes. There's what are called perfume sample kits. They're not actually specific perfumes. They're like little vials of the scents that are used up to make perfumes. So you have a little vial of camphor, a little vial of sandalwood, a little vial of musk, and you know, you can get various kits anywhere from, like, you know, 40 cents to several hundred cents that go into making perfume. So he had some of the, he had kits in this, and he asked the female subjects to rate these perfume samples, the various scents, as preference for self usage or for someone else to be using. So would you want to smell like this, or would you like somebody else to, you know, your guy to be smelling like this? What they found was for, at least with respect to the HLAs, it didn't seem to hold with the B series of genes or the DR series of genes, but with respect to the HLAs, there was a preference for sense for self, but not for others. Now, the best explanation for this is that if you can find a scent that matches that of your, at least some of these genes that are produced, reproduced, the A series of genes, if you can mimic the olfactory scent that's being produced by those, you can spread this further, right? I mean, how far away do you usually smell somebody? Hopefully not too far away, right? But if you can put that scent on, it's going to atomize and float away and attract potential mates in from further off. Right. Now keep in mind, in terms of your bodily odors, the actual basic body odor from sweat generally is not seen as being offensive or unpleasant. The stinky bodily odors from sweat that we don't like, that's actually because it's caused by bacteria that's living on your body. What that bacteria does is eat the sweat, all the salts and germs and oils that come out in the sweat. So the bacteria is eating your sebaceous gland secretions and then pooping out the remnants. So if you've got bad bodily odor, it's because of bacteria poop. It's not you, it's the bacteria poop that you're covered in. If that makes you feel any better or not, I don't know. But in terms of the actual, your actual olfactory signature, you don't generally find that offensive one way or the other. Okay? So if you can advertise further away, you're potentially drawing in a greater range of mates. Now, we said that both the mice, you know, mice will avoid males that smell very similar to themselves. And in the first study, the women were showing the greatest preference for the shirts that smelled different than, or had different MHC, from different MHC males than they did. So this is probably producing variability in your population, in your offspring. There's variation in the population. If you can pick someone who's different from you, your offspring are getting a more maximally different collection of MHC genes and alleles, some coming from mom, some coming from dad. Okay, this is what's called hybrid vigor. So the heterozygous condition conferring greater disease resistance. So being a hybrid lets you deal with potentially more things. Keep in mind, right, remember your parasite, your host, they're in this constant arms race, constantly upgrading new adaptations to deal with each defenses. If the offspring are very similar, so if you get two parents that are actually very similar, then all the children produced are going to be very similar. If the parasite can get into the adult and take out the adult, bam, it's going to take out the offspring as well. If the parents are different, then just mixing up those genes means that each of the kids is probably going to be somewhat different. Some of them may be similar to the parents. Others are going to be very different from the parents. You know, if the parasite gets in and takes out the parents, it may not take out all of the offspring. At least hopefully some will be more resistant. Now, interestingly enough, we see some kind of nifty things with blood groups. So we've got, you know, our basic blood groups, A, B, A, B, and O. So those are your blood types. Now, what blood does, basically, is carry your oxygen around. From a sort of evolutionary perspective, this is a little bit weird, right? Because, as it turns out, it doesn't matter whether you're A, B, A, B, or O, all of the different blood types carry oxygen equally well. So why the variation? That seems kind of wasteful. In fact, you would sort of think that through evolutionary processes, this would really, in fact, have taken this back down to just one type, the most effective type at carrying blood. But they all carry, carrying oxygen in the blood, but they all carry the oxygen equally well. But it turns out that actually different blood groups, different blood types, confer various protections against different diseases. So the different blood types seem to have evolved not because of their effect in terms of oxygen transportation, but because of resistance to parasites. So to give you some examples here, we talked about cholera. Now, cholera, is probably, as I said, over the history of our species, probably killed more of us than just about anything else. Individuals who are blood type AB are virtually immune to cholera. I mean, I'm not saying like, hey, here's a beaker of nothing but cholera, I dare you to drink it. But in an infected water system, they can, I mean, they may get a bit sick, but it's probably not going to kill them. And then working down, you know, if you're then A, you've got some resistance, B, a little bit. If you're blood type O, I mean, cholera is just going to nail you. Don't get cholera. Because blood type O people, so you say, okay, well, if cholera, you know, if blood type O people are just like going to be taken up by cholera, why hasn't O vanished? Well, turns out that people with blood type O have some resistance to malaria. You know, we talk about sickle cell anemia and resistance to malaria, but actually, in fact, people with blood type O, I mean, I'm not saying they're immune to malaria, but there's a bit of a resistance there. So it seems also as though people with blood type O may be a little bit resistant to certain types of cancers as well. That's just enough of an edge, perhaps, to keep that blood type in the population. And different populations of people, geographically isolated in different parts of the world, tend to show locally different proportions of the blood types linked to the local environment. Just quickly going to mention the Hutterites of North Dakota here. Hutterites are interesting for a lot of reasons, and I'm not just talking about their snappy dress sense, but from a sort of genetics and also from a sort of social cultural point of view, they're a fascinating group of people. If you don't know, they tend to live in relatively small farming communities. They're very cooperative within their farming communities. They don't do a lot of outbreeding. So geographically, they find husbands and wives from communities that are pretty close to them, which means that over generations, you've ended up with a very extended kinship network in a localized geographic region. Now, we've talked about this stuff in terms of tribal organizations, and that confers a lot of benefits in terms of kin-selected altruism, in terms of cooperative behavior. So that's kind of a real perk for a farming-based community, especially going back in time, say 19th century, when there wasn't a lot of, you're doing a lot of this by hand or with oxen pulling plows, this sort of stuff. So having tight kinship bonds are very useful, but this goes on long enough and you do start getting into issues with respect to inbreeding effects. Now, I'm in no way implying that within the same immediate family, like brothers are marrying sisters, it's not happening, right? But still, when did Hutterites come into North America? Mid-19th century. And they started from a fairly small gene pool to begin with because they were coming out of a Eastern European, a localized geographic region I think it started with something like 19 families that immigrated sort of en masse and set up in northwestern United States there, and then has moved out into Alberta and spread around. But what we find is because there's less variability in the genetics of the Hutterites, they're fairly good. Like, people just don't go and join up Hutterite communities. Right? I mean, they don't really go door to door and try to convince you to join the religion. And very few people just say, you know what? I think I'd love to become a Hutterite. I mean, you're kind of born into the Hutterite tradition, all right? And people leave it, but not a lot come out from inside. So it's very closed, which means there's limited genetic variability. You've got a limited number of partners to choose from. If you are of marriageable age, you can pretty much pick from those people that are locally around you. There may not be a lot of choice, is what I'm saying here. Okay? So what we find is in some work that's been done with the Hutterites of North Dakota,
we find more similar, you know, husbands and wives are more similar in terms of their MHCs than you would expect to find from other populations, simply because they don't have a lot of choice here. What are the consequences? Well, actually fewer pregnancies. The more similar the MHCs between the husband and wife are, fewer pregnancies that they have, and the more miscarriages they have. So, again, variability in your immune system seems to confer that hybrid vigor, greater health, greater chance of infant survival. Okay. I'm going to shift over from that side of Darwinian medicine. And I'm sorry, I fell behind at some point during the course here. Don't know how it happened. So we're going to have to try to rush through some of this stuff here. We'll see how much we can get through. But I'm going to talk quickly here about some issues with psychiatric problems and a Darwinian or an evolutionary approach to it. While there are a few psychiatric conditions that are caused by parasites, generally this is not the case. Generally, we see these as interactions between genes and environment are involved in psychiatric disorders. And one of the questions that commonly gets asked then is like, well, if psychiatric disorders that confer some sort of, you know, problem on the individual, shouldn't those be taken out by evolutionary processes? If they're not adaptive, if they're maladaptive, why hasn't evolution selected against them? And so this is one of the interesting sort of challenges for evolutionary arguments with respect to psychiatry and psychology for psychological issues. Why hasn't evolution eliminated these over the generations? And there's a variety of arguments that can be made. First he's going to mention is called the pleiotropy argument. So genes, predispositions with respect to psychiatric disorders may also have inclusive fitness benefits in other ways. So because, remember, genes can do lots of different things. You don't just have a gene for this, right? Genes make a protein. That protein can get together with lots of other proteins and be used in all different parts of the body for all different kinds of things, right? We only have 30,000 odd genes, but you put all those protein combinations together and you can do lots and lots and lots of different stuff. So while a particular protein may predispose you towards a particular type of psychiatric disorder, the same protein, perhaps combined with the genetic products of other genes, has some other effect. So the phenotypic expression here could come up in lots of different ways. So as long as the positive effects with respect to inclusive fitness outweigh the negative effects from psychiatric disorder, the genes keep getting propagated along. Again, this in a way gets back down to, you know, says, well, okay, so as long as the individual, you know, again, we talk about the behavior of the individual there, and this gets into this issue of, you know, Dawkins' selfish gene. Well, if it was just down an individual gene, that might be problematic with the gene, but remember, the behavior, you know, we're talking about the genes of the individual are involved here. So overall, if the individual's overall different reproductive success is higher, that gene just keeps moving along with the rest of it. Okay, so pleiotropy is one possible explanation. The time lag. And we've seen this in other cases. It's like, yeah. Sure. You know what? That is maladaptive. And you know what? Evolution probably will take care of it. But you know how long that's going to take? Well, I don't either. But it's going to be a while. Okay? Yes, we've discussed this. And yeah, there has been evolutionary adjustments in the human genome over the last 10,000 years. No question. But still, you know, the environment's changed markedly since the EEA. It just may take a while for these genetic effects to catch up, to get these things out. Especially when you look at a lot of things about our, you know, kind of modern industrialized world, right? Industrial Revolution, only a few hundred years. Oh, sure, that's like, well, I don't know, how many generations? 12? 10? Not very long. So yeah, there's some selective pressures happening perhaps, but it might just take a bit longer. We're playing catch-up perhaps. So that could explain some of these as well. They are perhaps being selected against. They just haven't been eliminated yet. The compromise.
we've talked about this. We said evolution doesn't optimize systems, right? Evolution produces systems that are, all right, it's good enough. You get by. You got to compromise, okay? A pelvic girdle to let us walk bipedally. Yeah, the trade-off is we give birth pretty early, only after, you know, 9 months gestation instead of over 20. Is it perfect? No. Does it usually work? Yeah, mostly. Okay. So, you know, looking at it this way, it's like, okay, social cognition, right? We get a lot of genes involved in that frontal cortex. Social cognition, very important for our species, but you know what? There can also be some downsides with that. Right? You start worrying a bit more about what people are saying about you. You get a little bit neurotic about things. What? It's a compromise. Right? It's a trade-off situation. Would you rather have no social cognition? Right? Autistics don't generally care what people think about them. Wouldn't it be nice? You know? I don't care what people are saying about me. Why not? I don't care about people. There you go. And you're probably not going to reproduce either, are you? No, probably not. Do you care about that? Not really. All right. Okay, so trade-offs. Trade-offs in these things. So compromise. Again, it just comes down to, as long as you've got a sufficient degree of differential reproductive success, maintained, the genes will continue. Trait variation. Just says, look, allelic forms, train genes, traits, some behavioral trait, physiological trait, they will fall along some sort of normal distribution curve. So if we look at the overall population. We're going to spread out in Gaussian. Individuals' characteristics are going to be due to your genes, your environmental effects. Again, Gaussian distribution on this. The vast majority of individuals fall somewhere in the middle, within a couple of standard deviations of the mean. Yeah. Just through random variation, trait variation, some are going to be out on the extremes. Just the random collection of stuff that came in on sperm and stuff that came in on egg. Sometimes you get some outlier traits. Not most individuals, but every now and then. And the outliers, perhaps, those are individuals with certain psychiatric disabilities. We talked about this in autism, you know, the idea of the male brain. You know, the idea that perhaps only after you cross some threshold of genetic characteristics, traits, do you move from just being, wow, he is such a guy, into brawl, that's autism. Right? So, well, yeah, why does it continue? Well, just through random chance, you are going to get some outliers. The outliers are those that have these traits. Okay, so those are some possibilities for why psychiatric, psychological disorders, conditions have not been evolutionarily eliminated yet. Let's take a look at a few different issues here. So, anxiety disorders. Let me make this clear. If you've got an anxiety disorder, that's can be pretty disabling. It's not pleasant, right? But remember what we've talked about in terms of emotions here, these negative emotion states, things like fear, right? This would be very adaptive. Okay, so not going to the point of an anxiety disorder yet, but just being able to experience anxiety. That's basic. That's adaptive, right? A little bit of test anxiety, maybe a good thing. Maybe I should study. Whole bunch of test anxiety, such that your non-functional exam, that's a bad thing, right? But anxiety in itself, that's actually very useful. Okay, feelings of apprehension and nervousness can have some real advantages. You have things like xenophobia. It's an interesting one. So it's the fear of Xena, princess warrior, which interestingly has only started showing up in the population since the early 1990s, but spread very rapidly, probably because of the ability of people to move around on planes and interbreed with one another at science fiction fantasy conventions. I'm working up a paper on that one. No. Xenophobia is just the fear of the other, the fear of the unknown, the fear of something that is different.
which actually, you know, fits the bill for Xena Princess Warrior 2. But so it's just fear of the alien, fear of the somebody that's different. But again, we've talked about this in terms of, you know, in groups and out groups, right? You meet someone that's part of your group, they're not an unknown. You know how they're going to respond culturally to you. You know the rules. You meet up with someone who's from a totally different group. What do you do? How do you deal with that? Okay? How do you fit in? That's nervous. You meet someone, you get into a relationship with someone who's maybe out of a different sort of ethnic or cultural background, right? You got to go meet the family. Right? What are the rules? You don't want to make a social faux pas. That can be kind of, you know, nerve-wracking. Probably very, very... Anxiety is probably extremely ancestral. Take a look at early mammals. Eomea. There's a little skeleton of Eomea over there. It goes back about 125 million years. One of the earliest mammals. We came from stuff like that. So Eomea, 125 million years, one of the earliest, early mammal as well, but one of the earliest primates, in fact, actually, or early primates, led to primates. Primate ancestors, primates came from things that look sort of like modern tree shrews. So these are modern tree shrews. So this is what our primate ancestors look. They don't quite look like monkeys, really, but that's eventually what led to... things like that, little all of us. They're small insectivores, so they eat small bugs. Keep in mind, going back 125 million years, there were bugs that were bigger than the mammals, right? And so they'd be eating mammals too. Okay, so I mean everything, even the bugs was eating mammals. We were snack food. It was like chicken McNuggets, right? I mean, everybody loves the. I mean, yeah. So things like Eomea would have been food for anything that was bigger than it. I mean, birds, reptiles, amphibians, invertebrates, dinosaurs, you name it. Tough break for the little guys. So you can imagine that they're probably, you know, kind of high on the anxiety measure, right? But that's probably good. I mean, if your ability to fight off, I mean, if you can't really take down anything larger than a worm or maybe a cockroach that's smaller than you, you got to be a bit anxious about the situation. And being anxious about things perhaps focuses attention. What's the threat here? Should I duck out of my burrow to go look for food? Is there something dangerous in the area? Or do you just go, la-di-da, off I go for the night, and you get eaten. Anxiety prepares, sets you up for a species-specific defense reaction, the freeze, flight, fight mode. Now, think about this like a smoke detector. It's in fact sometimes called the smoke detector model. Or, as I like to say, better safe than dead. So it's like, oh, I don't... It's like, should I go out tonight and look for food? Should I go out right now? What was that? I'm just going to go back in my burrow. Well, maybe it was food that you could have eaten coming by. You know, maybe a worm went and made a noise and it was scary and you ducked back into your burrow because you can't see what it is. Okay, you missed out on that worm. But what if it was actually a predator that was just going to kill and eat you? If you think, oh no, maybe it's just a worm, and you get it wrong, and you get eaten, well, you're dead. If you get it wrong, and it was something you could have eaten, you missed out on that meal opportunity, but hopefully there'll be another. Once you're dead, you can't get any more meal opportunities. You are that last meal opportunity for somebody else. So the consequences of being anxious when not necessary, well, false alarm, is better than not being anxious when you should. Think of it as a smoke detector. Anyone set off your smoke detector when cooking? Right? It's like, ah, my poor omelet, stop going off, smoke alarm, get you, I'm suffering enough without dinner now, right? It's like, oh, why don't you just unplug your smoke detector? Well, because what if your house really is burning down? That's your kind of warning on it. It's better to put up with the silly thing going off when it's just you burning an omelet than it is to miss out on, you know, being alive. So, could we then be evolved for constant anxiety? In other words, anxiety disorders. Well, no, probably not. For short periods of time, existing in a state of heightened anxiety for short periods is not a problem for us, right?
but it's very physiologically stressful. So if you've got long-term anxiety, this is putting a lot of strain on the body. Heart, going fast, increased respiration, blood pressure. You're under stress for a long time, I mean, aneurysms, the heart just gives out, heart valve breaks down, all kinds of stuff. Go bad, okay? Leaving aside the physiological stressors and risks, there's the costs involved in lost time, foraging, mating, childbearing. The more time you're stuck in a state of high anxiety, you're not doing any of this other stuff. So we're not really well adapted for long periods of anxiety, but for short term, you know, kind of useful. Okay, so let's consider. Why is it that anxiety disorders still exist? Why haven't we evolved away from these then? Could talk about this in terms of a time lag interpretation. So perhaps perhaps we're good now at dealing with anxiety of predators and things like that, but you know, we just haven't had time to adapt to the fact that perhaps in the West there aren't that many predators left. Right? We've gotten rid of all. I mean, what attacks and eats a person in Canada? Okay, the occasional cougar or bear or something like that, but you know, in a city. The last time someone was eaten by a cougar in Edmonton. Yeah, never. Victoria, sure. They hang out in car parks waiting to leap on people. Okay, once. So one possibility is that we simply haven't gotten used to the fact that most of these things that activate anxiety situations aren't present in Western environments so much anymore. We just haven't evolved to a timeline. You could look at it on the flip side and say, possibly, on the other hand, maybe the problem is with the modern features which allow you to actually stay in a heightened state of anxiety. So consider agoraphobia. Right? So agoraphobics afraid of Angora sweaters. Agoraphobia afraid of going out. Engaging, so they tend to stay as recluses, as shut-ins. Now, go back in time. Let's pop back into the EEA. If you're agoraphobic and afraid to leave your hut or your cave, sooner or later you're going to get really, really hungry, and you got to go out and void your bladder somewhere. Sooner or later you got to step out of the cave. Nowadays, you don't really have to go out and forage, right? Panago delivers. Phone up Safeway. They'll deliver food to shut-ins. You can even get a job from home. It may not be the greatest job in the world, but you can do that. You don't actually ever have to leave. You can actually just stay in your anxiety state. You don't have to actually ever confront it and force through it. So possibilities there. Another possibility, how anxiety could be maintained, trait variation. So we just might be having problems here with just the extremes of that Gaussian distribution, right? Most people, you know, within a couple standard deviations of the mean there, no problems, no big problems. You got some people that are actually just not really anxious about anything. Have you started studying yet for the finals? No, it'll be fine, dude. Really? Are you sure? It's like people like really fail in this kind of thing. It's like, no, what could go wrong? Let's go in. Write something. That'd be cool. We'll see how that goes, so that's the low end of trait variation. In other words, you're not anxious about anything. Aren't you worried about walking down, through... Edmonton doesn't really have anywhere that you probably can't walk around safely in the middle of the night. We're not really a terribly threatening or dangerous city, so it's like, ooh, 97th Street is... there's other cities in the world where it's like, hey, you just don't go there. Aren't you worried about wandering around in the center of the urban ghetto at 4 in the morning? What could go wrong? Man's decapitated body found. The other end is like the extreme anxiety. Everything causes anxiety. So, trait variation, too little, too much. So different ways we could account for that. How about depression? Depression is what we call affective disorder, so mood disturbances, depression. We can talk about reactive depression. This is normal, actually. So reactive depression is just normal responses to some specific life event.
Then we've got endogenous and clinical depression. This is severe. It's long term. It may not be related to any particular event. And this is what most people think about when they think of depression or clinical depression. We can also talk about there's different forms. There's unipolar depression. There's bipolar depression. And taking a look at this, there's at least three sort of classes of evolutionary models that would apply. Depression's actually been of a lot of interest to evolutionary theorists with respect to this. So ultimate cause models of depression. You could say, well, depression's an adaptive trait, right? So you get depressed as in response to some adverse condition here. And that may actually provide motivation for some action. Something goes wrong, this makes you depressed, that motivates you perhaps to do something so you're no longer depressed. Okay. So that's one possibility. Second, pleiotropy. It could be that there's just genes that will increase fitness in some way, shape, or form, but will also predispose an individual to depression. What could such genes be? Well, some people have suggested things like genes for creativity or introspectionism. You take a look at, say, artists, right? Many artists that are very creative are also prone to depression. Now, it's correlational. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of artists that don't get depressed about things. You know, why should I be depressed? I'm doing great. Who knew these horrible paintings of girls with large eyes crying? Go walk through Hub at the little store there. It's like, they're all over the place. People keep buying them. Oh, I know it's crap, but... Don't you feel that you're not being true to your artistic vision? I just bought a Porsche. Okay. So I'm sure there's a lot of artists out there that actually don't get all that depressed about things. But, you know, we don't hear about them. You always hear about the brooding artists. So, okay, possible. Trait variation. Could just be a chance of the mixed up genes, you know, the conception. It's outliers in the population. Most people don't get that depressed. Most people experience reactive depression. But, you know, you end up with clinical depression. Another possibility here is that it involves developmental disruption. Okay, so some ultimate explanation. It could be an environmental disruption issue during childhood. So we've got genetically normal individuals that experience something. Could be toxins, could be neurological damage during development, and this could lead to something happening which causes clinical depression outside of normal events. Could be possibly it's not an environmental issue in terms of an acute situation, but something dealing with social interaction, so abandonment, lack of social interaction, missing a critical developmental period for bonding with parents, these sorts of things. Developmental disruption models are generally phenotypic interpretations. So it says something happens and behaviorally this changes. The genes aren't really any different because the genes are normal, but it's the environment. So some sort of extreme environmental situation leads to a perturbation there. Then you got like ultimate proximate interactions. So one of these that we're going to talk about, one of these from originally developed by Price in 67, called the social competition hypothesis. It says depression occurs. Oh, you do something. Something occurs, and you go down in social status. Your social status decreases. Experience some sort of conflict. You get into a conflict with someone in the social hierarchy and you lose, so you experience the loss. Somebody takes your girlfriend or boyfriend, you don't win the big school meet, you lose out on something, you didn't get to be valedictorian, whatever it happens to be, right? So this leads to a fall in your status. Now, Price argues that this fall, this personal loss, triggers the depression. So that's the reactive process, if you will. So you become depressed. Now, by becoming depressed, you appear less threatening to whoever just beat you out or won. So he says the depression is actually a nonverbal form of communication. It's ending the conflict, saying, okay, I've lost, right? So depression, not making eye contact, not having good posture, slump, looking smaller, actually physically withdrawing from the area. So this could minimize the conflict right then, reduce it, thereby stop any sort of immediate threat, prevent escalation of the conflict over whatever it was. This depression then may also allow the individual to accept the defeat. Instead of going back and trying to win again and just getting smacked down again, try to go back, smack down again. Think Kung Fu Panda, right? Po's in the first movie, getting smacked around. And again, he's just going, oh, you know, bring it again. Right, again, it's like, won't he just stay down? It's like, nope, apparently not. You know, maybe if he'd just been a little more depressed, he would never have become the Dragon Warrior. Yes, I have children. I've seen every Disney movie ever made many, 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 many times. Now we're seeing them in 3D. Hey, Vervet Monkeys and Serotonin. Vervet Monkeys have a very well-established social hierarchy. The alpha male has the highest serotonin levels. The beacon. Now, if the alpha loses his status somehow, gets into a confrontation with another male, gets beaten out, is no longer the alpha. Behaviorally, I mean, if you were to look at one of these monkeys, you'd say, that's one sad-looking monkey. That monkey just looks depressed. Well, interestingly enough, he doesn't just look depressed. Neurochemically, he becomes depressed. His serotonin levels, they plummet. They take a dive. You take this monkey, you give him Prozac. Ba-ba! Prozac is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. He's back to acting like an alpha monkey. Wait a minute, dude, didn't you just lose? I know, but I feel strong. I feel great. I'm going to kick me some monkey butt. Okay? So the fallen alpha's depression goes away. Starts acting like an alpha again. You take a non-alpha male. Take the beta males. You know, take the omega male. Right? The omega's like the bottom of the social heap. Shoot that one up with a whole bunch of Prozac. Suddenly it's like, I feel like a god. Monkey god. Right? Bam. He starts acting like an alpha. It's like, wait a minute, dude, you're like the weakest of the weak. How can you... Oh yeah, he may still get his monkey butt handed to him when he gets into a fight with some other dominant monkey, but at least he thinks he's doing great. So maybe that was it. Maybe Poe, Kung Fu Panda, just has way too much serotonin. Maybe it's in his dad's noodles or something. You know, Prozac noodles. There could be some issues in the modern environment, taking a look at the modern environment here. A lot of mass communication, right? Back in the EEA, if you were comparing yourself, you know, your sort of status, your abilities, your phenotypic cues, your signals, well, who are you comparing to? Well, other people in a relatively small social group, right? You know, 150 people in your tribe sort of thing, half men, half women, so, you know, within sex, like less than 100 people you're comparing yourself with. Well, now, TV and movies, I mean, what are we getting with actors, actresses, models? We're the best of the world, right? These are the hottest, most attractive, most glamorous, best singers, most athletic, whatever it is, from all over the world. Modeling agencies, television, acting shows, they can pick the best. You're not just comparing yourself to your little local population of, you know, peeps that you're around frequently. You're exposing yourself to the best of the best of the best of the, well, you know, the cream of 6 billion humans. How the hell do you compete with that, right? But that's what we're exposed to. You make these comparisons to movie stars, to models, whatnot. Negative body image. I mean, you know, I'm not in the best physical shape. Take a look at other, you know, 43-year-old males with kids living in, you know, the area I do, and I'm not that different, better than some, worse than others. But, you know, I start comparing myself to George Clooney, and good gods, I should just probably kill myself right now. I mean... You know, my job is wrapping up, I'm balding, slightly pear-shaped, and I'm growing a slightly, I do sometimes wear a ridiculous beard. Anyways. So taken to extreme, that can lead to depression. Other things here. We don't live in tight family groups anymore. Our community structure is kind of broken down. At least I think it's fair to say it's very different from how we probably existed back in the EEA. Tend to lack a kinship support network. How many people live with your extended family? 3 generations, 1 household. Anybody? No, that's more or less what I expected, right? You got a kinship network. There's a lot of indirect fitness benefits. Okay, they're going to help you out. If you've got small social groups, reciprocal arrangements, you've got a support network here. Let's think about something like postpartum depression. Okay, postpartum depression could be a non-linguistic way to communicate stress. So post-childbirth, stress, need some help. Now, you're non-linguistic. Two words, sounds like, okay. How do you do this? How do you, without language? Well, by behaving depressed. Right, going back to Price's idea that demonstrating depression makes you look less threatening. Well, if you can recognize that as an emotional state, yeah, those are all the signs of depression. That's the how can, what can we do? So someone gives birth, it's difficult. Raising a young kid, it's a lot of effort. You're tired, you've gone through, for the women, you've gone through very difficult labor there. You need some assistance. Now, so it's been tough. You demonstrate some cues of depression. But you're not around. You don't have a tight social network. People aren't around you very much. They don't pick up on it. Uh-oh. Your communication wasn't received. What do? Resend. Amplify and resend. Just act a little more depressed. Then they'll get, but again, you don't got a good social network, good group of friends, people that you're connected with. Again, they miss it. More depressed. What's this? Communicate louder. Start shouting. Well, you're not shouting, but start behaviorally shouting. At some point, this crosses the line. We get into some pretty serious effects of postpartum depression, possibly ending in murder-suicides. Well, you know, that can be the extreme case. Okay? So, this can be an issue here. Unfortunately, I've run out of time. So, if people don't have anywhere to go, I can sit and finish this chapter, but... Well, anyways, we got through a good chunk of it there. The notes are there. You can take a look at those. The textbook has the material on this. Now, got your papers to return. I just need to very quickly pop the grades in here and get your papers back to you. I wasn't able to get the last assignment graded in time, so I'll have that for you tomorrow, but you can at least have the paper back.